Professor Mike Olmert, Department of English, University of Maryland. Tell me a little bit about this play that you've written about Daryl Hill, and what was the genesis of that play?
Well, a friend of mine from high school, he's a Montgomery County judge. His name is Billy Rowan. He was a few years older ahead of me in high school, and he went to Gonzaga, I went to St. John's, and we hate each other. And at least that's what it seemed like when we were played basketball against each other when we were 18 and 19. Anyhow, he called me up and told me that that his friend Daryl Hill was thinking about having a book, his story, between covers. And I was being vetted as the writer for that. And I said, all right, I'll think about it. Because I don't, this is sports memoirs books. I don't know who, they're like cookbooks. I don't know who reads them. People buy them for the pictures. Whatever, I was probably wrong about that. John Feinstein certainly does it really well, and so does Frank DeFord. But they were coming to me. So I took a lunch at the Grill on campus. It's a great place to go. And we talked about 2 hours. This was in January of 2009, actually. A year went past, and finally last January 2010, I sent an email to him. I said, you still want to do this thing? And so we had another meeting at the Grill, and I said, I don't want to write a book about you, but I want to try it as a play. And he was a little skeptical about that, but he played along. And so from the middle of January till the middle of May, we went to lunch every Wednesday. And I mean, it was a 3-hour lunch. And I was his psychiatrist, and I was his pain-in-the-ass interviewer, and I asked him some tough questions. And the thing about Daryl is he's not just a football player. He's very, very smart. Anyhow, he told me his story, and it's just amazing. Now, I was a Maryland fan. I had graduated the year before he came to Maryland. And I remember listening to those games on the radio because I had to work on Saturdays. I didn't actually see him play in person, but I listened to those games. And I mean, he just changed the world for us. And he made Maryland football, which was kind of a non-entity, at least for the last 4 or 5 years, really exciting again. And so he changed the world. But he also changed the world in a much more significant way because he was the first black player in the ACC. That is to say, he's the first black player in any Southern Conference. I mean, there were black players in Michigan and Iowa and in the Northeast and on the West Coast in college ball, but it's a different thing in the South. One of the things that significantly Daryl said to me, and it's in the play, was that it was hard for Jackie Robinson to do what he did in 1949. That was difficult. But it's quite a different thing to be a black man playing in Brooklyn or Chicago or New York or Boston, Cleveland, than being a black man to play in Death Valley and Clemson. And a stadium that's ringed, it was then ringed by flagpoles with the stars and bars of the Confederate States. So I admired Daryl for what he did then, and I really admire him now because he, after his football career was over, he didn't really stick on with the pro team. So he had a lovely and important college career, but he moved on to other things and he became an international entrepreneur. He made lots of money. He's a very successful businessman. And it doesn't surprise me. He has a great personality. He loves the stories. He has really a lot of recall about those years, and he must have been busy, and they must have seemed like a whirlwind. But he's very frank about what happened to him. He said it almost didn't happen because he didn't grow up wanting to be Jackie Robinson. He just wanted to be a football player. And I really admired that. I mean, he's a little reluctant about this, but it's a story to tell, and he thinks it needs to be told, and I do too.
The other part of that story, too, is that it took a lot of guts. It was a challenge for the University of Maryland and for the coaching staff to break this barrier.
One of the things that we tend to forget in Maryland is that we live below the Mason-Dixon line, and that's a line that I used in the play, too. In 1962, when Daryl was available to come to Maryland, it was really a different world out there. It was difficult for Maryland to do what it did. But I think one of the heroes of the play is not just Daryl, but the president here at the time, his name was Wilson Elkins. He was a Rhodes Scholar, historian from the University of Texas in Oxford, and he'd been here for about a decade, and he'd seen a vast expansion in the football fortunes of the team. There, Jim Tatum was a big coach here, and he had left to go to North Carolina. Maryland had been in the Orange Bowl. They were a major player on the football scene, but without any black players, of course. So the coach, Tom Nugent, and his assistant coach, Lee Corso, who you still see every Saturday on ESPN game day, they had the idea of this local boy, Darryl Hill, coming to play for Maryland. He was a high school student at Gonzaga, the Jesuit high school in downtown Washington, D.C. It's still there. He's still a huge hero with everybody that's ever been to Gonzaga. And went to Elkins and said, we should have this guy here. Now, the problem with Maryland was having a black student at the University of Maryland wasn't a problem. There were over 200 black students here out of a school population that was probably about 25,000. It's not a lot, but still it wasn't path-breaking to do that. What would be path-breaking is to have him on the teams, because that meant this player would have to step into, on away games, into segregated football facilities. And as Darryl remembers, the coach of the Clemson Tigers coming up to him before a game, Darryl had walked onto the field because he was also a place kicker, and punters and place kickers and kickoff men go out early before the rest of the teams to practice because they need more room to kick the ball around before the field gets filled with bodies. So Darryl is out there, and this man walks up to him. It's the coach of the other team, and Darryl is really intimidated because he's one of the most famous football coaches in the country. Frank Howard, he dresses and acts like Bear Bryant of Atlanta, of Alabama. In fact, wears the same houndstooth hat. And he comes up to Darryl and says, "You're not doing anything today, boy." He used some very sweary words, which I won't reproduce here, but they're in the play. He says, "You're not doing anything today. You're all alone. You're the only black person here." And probably didn't say black. "You're the only black person here. They're not selling hot dogs. They're not sweeping the street. There's nobody here." He said, "Look around. You're not doing anything." So actually, ironically, blacks from South Carolina could come to that game for free. They had to sit outside the stadium on a hill. And there are pictures of them sitting out there. You know, just looks like a black picnic. You know, it's a really bucolic scene, families and picnic baskets and people sitting down watching football. And that's the close shot. You pull back, you see a stadium with Confederate flags all around it, and they're not wanting it inside. Well, a few minutes after the coach came up and said that to Darryl and scared the bejesus out of him, he just really... one of the managers came up and said, "Darryl, they're not letting your mother in the stand." Now, Darryl's mother is also an important part of the story. She was a Latin teacher in the Washington, D.C. school system. She was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Howard University, a long-term Latin scholar, and all but dissertation PhD researcher from Catholic University. She went to all his away games. His father couldn't because he had a trucking company and was required for deliveries every Friday. So he never saw any of his son's away games, but she always came. And she goes to Clemson, and she's not admitted. And this is one of the nice things. I mean, there's a sense in which some people from South Carolina are going to hate this story because we say some very bad things. We're not making them up, though. But here's a nice thing. The president of Clemson University found out that this black woman from Washington, D.C., the mother of a football player, was not being allowed in the stadium. He came down to the gate and invited her in, and invited her to watch the game from the president's box, which is a remark, because he, and in a way, he might have put his life on the line, too, doing that. That's a very brave and civilized thing. And it's what we would expect of universities, which are supposed to be civilized places. Anyhow, so kudos to that man. His name was Edwards, Robert Edwards. That's a very nice part of the story. And not only that, they invited Palestine Hill to spend the night in the president's mansion in Clemson, South Carolina. So it's a great story all around.
Now, you were working on this play during a class that you were teaching here. And I know that at least I went to hear a reading of that play a little bit later on. But I what I'm interested in is to find out the reaction of your students, especially here at Maryland, because we flash forwarded now, you know, decades really, and being integrated, having a very diverse community here at the university is something that these kids come here for. They expect it to happen. But this was something that they may never have heard of before.
No, none of them had heard of this player, and none of them had heard of this brave act being played out on this campus. That surprised all of them. And they did like the play. And undergraduates, I had 8 undergraduates who read all the characters. There's about 22 characters in the play. So by doubling them, we rehearsed it for 3 or 4 days and then put it on. There must have been 300 or 400 people there. And they liked the story. And what they really liked was also after the play, we had a talk back. And Daryl and I were sitting on the stage. And the reaction to Daryl, to the story, that now that everyone knew it, and they asked him really interesting questions. And he really fed off the energy of the crowd. It was really a nice hour. I mean, no one wanted to go. Usually the talkbacks after plays last for 20 minutes, and then people have had enough.
Is there a central message in this story that you, as the author, wanted to get out?
First of all, it's not a sports movie. It's about making sacrifices for other people, and it's about giving up a part of your life that you could never get back. Unquestionably, Daryl's life would have been easier if he had just been a football player, say, in Michigan or Notre Dame or something like that. But coming here, he put himself in a much larger stage, and he put himself under the microscope, and the whole world was watching. It really circumscribed his college experience. He was always on stage, always had to be careful, I think he feels that he didn't have a normal college experience.
But yet he took that experience, and he was a success in his life. He moved on,
yeah,
and became really bigger than what his college experience was all about.
I think that it really contributed a lot to his success as an entrepreneur, because what he had to do and what his coaches said, no matter how bad the people get, and they said awful things during these games, and they're in the play too, I have to say, that he could never, ever react. He always had to react with self-control, and that's what you have to do in business. You have to have that poker face, and you can't get mad. It's just business, and I think that I could see that is really a large part of him. His mother was a Latin teacher too, and I mean, this happens again and again. I mean, when the Trojans lose the war to the Greeks, what Aeneas wants to do is he wants to kill Helen of Troy, because his whole nation has been destroyed because of this woman. And Venus comes to him and talks him out of it. This self-control, virtus, virtue. You need to, and that's what he had. There's people all over the South. Whenever he went away, it was a horror show. People dressed up in Ku Klux Klan outfits saying terrible things to him. No matter what they said, he could never sink to their level. So, I mean, I think the classics and his mother's classical background helped. So it's a really interesting story. It's about self-control. But still, he had to give up things. He knows on balance. Well, of course it was better for the state of Maryland and for the United States what he did, and for our society, because a few years later we get the Great Society and the blossoming of the Civil Rights Movement. He's right there in the beginning. Ironically, Daryl Hill finds himself on the end of criticism from Black people. Stokely Carmichael and H. Ralph Brown are not happy with him. They want him to have protests at Maryland to get more Blacks in the state. But it was an embarrassment that only 250 people, Black people, were in the University of Maryland. He needed to demonstrate on the campus and make a lot of noise. And Daryl said, no, I'm not doing that. Maryland's been really nice to me. I'm not dumping on them. And finally, Stokely Carmichael came around and said, you're right. We don't need you being an enemy. You just need to be the poster boy. You get yourself on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And he practically did that and was really important in the civil rights movement. That's a really nice takeaway message.
Now, you have an event coming up on March 21st. Tell me a little bit about that.
There's a moment in the life of every play, and it's an event called a staged reading, in which professional actors read the play in front of an audience, and it's called a stage reading or a script in hand performance. They don't memorize any lines. They just read them off the script. There are no costumes. There are no scenery. There's no props. So you get just the essence of the play. You get the words, but they're rehearsed and they're acted out. And so this is a stage reading. That will be on Monday night, the 21st of March. And it's being held at the historically black and restored Lincoln Theater on U Street in Northwest Washington, which is the hottest part of town. That's full of jazz clubs and clubs that the kids go and dance.
What do you foresee for this play in the future? What do you hope that the ultimate end game will be with it?
Well, we'd like to have a full production with actors and costumes and scenery and all that stuff. And if it goes well on the 21st, and it's looking more and more like it will, because a lot of people like this play. And certainly Maryland graduates love this play, because it makes the university, quite rightly, look really brave, and it makes them heroic. And Wilson Elkins and the coaching staff and the people that made this difficult, it would have been much easier for them not to do it. But it had to happen sometime. And if it was going to happen in any school in the Atlantic Coast Conference, it had to happen at Maryland. Because that's not going to come from the south up. It's going to come from the north down. And they made a lot of, you know, that ACC meeting in the spring of 1962 was really ugly, because they said, you know, you can't play in any of our stadiums. And the coach, Tom Nugent, said, well, why? They said, well, you know, because black people, they're segregated. They're not allowed. He said, well, look, that's your problem. That's not our problem. And some schools let them have this player play, but not at Clemson. They just let him play. They said, well, you know, we'll just take him out of the game early. And here's another remarkable thing. Although people in the stands were always yelling awful things at Darryl, no players ever did. I mean, they took shots at them, but that's going to happen anytime. But as the game wore on, Darryl could always feel that the players were on his side. You know, they pat him on the back occasionally. When Darryl goes to Wake Forest, it's the same ugly crowds saying awful things. But before the game, the running back for the Wake team, the Brian Piccolo, who would go on to have a great career in the NFL and be the hero of one of the greatest sports films of all time, Brian Song, he came out to the middle of the field and shook hands with Darryl, and they took off their helmets and talked. Which wound up some people in the crowd a little more, but some of the people, you know, appreciated, certainly some of the Wake people appreciated Brian Piccolo had done, and it was very brave of him. But still, there were ugly things going on. In the end of the Wake game, Darryl was hurt. He was stretching out for to make a catch and ran into the goalpost, and it spun him around and knocked him out. And the emergency ambulance guys came out on the field, and they hesitated because he was really they were going to give him oxygen, but they'd never put an oxygen mask on a black person's face before, these people, and they didn't know whether they should do it. And one of Darryl's best friends, Jerry Fishman, who was a fierce linebacker on the Maryland team, grabbed the face mask away from the EMT technician and put it on Darryl's face himself. But even as that game went on, Darryl was noticing that the players were beginning to appreciate him more and recognize him just as a football player and not as a black one. You know, Darryl, that's the thing about Darryl. That's what Darryl had to give up. He never could really just be a football player. He was always a black football player. And that has a little tenderness for him to this moment. But here's another thing that he says. And I think this is very brave of him. He says that he actually, in an ironic way, sort of thrived off and prospered off the hate. Because when he heard that stuff, it just steeled his conviction that he needs to be as good as he can be all the time. And he thought without that, maybe he wouldn't have been as good a player. You know, because he said that he always played better in games than he did in practice, because the ugliness got him up. So there's something ironic about that, too. And Darryl's a citizen of the world now. And this experience at Maryland is something that you couldn't pay for and you can't predict. But I think we all benefited from it. But in lots of ways, his life was constricted, he thinks. And I think, too. I mean, I spent a lot of time with him. I mean, I'm his psychiatrist. I got lots of notes. And they'll all be, someday they'll all be going into the University of Maryland archives, and you'll be able to see the things that he told me. If you can read my handwriting, good luck on that one, too.
Professor Mike Olmert, Department of English here at the University of Maryland, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.